My name is Patricia Smith from Canby, Oregon. I am a wife, mother, teacher, and a daughter of two aging parents. No one in this room wishes to die sooner than necessary, nor do any of us want our lives unduly prolonged if our time has come. For every sad story of a comatose or suffering patient, there are several stories of persons who were not supposed to make it, but they did. They are here to tell us about it and are leading productive lives. The real question today is not is there a problem, but does Senate Bill 20 adequately address the problem? I think not. Legislation regarding life-death decision-making must do two things. First of all, it must address the questionable situations in a clear, well-defined manner which protects persons outside of the crisis states. Today, we have heard fairly clear and well-defined descriptions of vegetable situations and vegetative situations and this kind of thing. Why cannot the law be a little more clear in its definition? The second thing it must do is state clearly who holds the authority and responsibility. Senate Bill 20 inadequately attempts the second and fails to do the first. Its ambiguity and free choice stance places a blanket of vulnerability on every living person to an untimely death with the phrase active and natural process of dying. In the next section, I have outlined things that have been covered very well today already, but I would like to address the control factors that need to be included in pro-life legislation. The four control factors which are missing in Senate Bill 20 are, first of all, the nature of the illness, the reversibility, the duration, and fourth of all, the competency of the decision maker. The primary person holding authority and responsibility for decisions should be competent. Section 4 of Senate Bill 20 allows the patient to revoke a directive regardless of mental or physical condition, a directive that they made while competent. This could prolong life for a patient choosing option 1 of the directive, but it could end life for a patient who originally chose option 3 of the suggested directive. For example, 20 years ago, my mother, seriously ill in the hospital, reached a low emotional level and stated, "I just want to die." Interpreted in context, physician and family knew she did not literally mean what she stated. Under Senate Bill 20, her statement would be an oral directive given while incapacitated with a mandate for obedience by the doctor and the family. And I might add that had I been an exploitive daughter and SB 20 was in effect, I might have ended the life of my parent. God forbid. An ambulance moved her from Roseburg to Sacred Heart Hospital in Eugene, where a fine doctor did a second surgery. At home 2 weeks later, she pointed to a nearby hill and said, "I'm going to climb that hill again." Now, 20 years later, she enjoys healthy life at age 75. I think we need to look at the purposes of Senate Bill 20. They seem to kind of level out on three different levels. First of all, there is a very clear stated purpose to give competent adults the right to choose or participate in decisions, even though they can revoke that decision in a state of incapacity. Patients already have space for wide choices, to go to the doctor or hospital or stay home, to take medications or throw away the prescription, to accept or deny chemotherapy, radiation, kidney dialysis, etc. But my nonverbal message as a patient entering a healthcare facility is, please relieve my suffering and please help me live. That is why I've come. Senate Bill 20, in giving wide legal immunity to physicians, may actually decrease patient choice. And the third point there is that the value of life must supersede the value of free choice. Senate Bill 20 places personal choice above life and thus endorses suicide. Second level is apparent purposes, and these seem to come through as the four that are listed: to protect medical doctors and hospitals against excessive liability, to increase the decision-making responsibility of patients, family, and friends in order to ease the emotional and financial burdens, to give clear decision-making authority to doctor and family for treatment of patient judged to be incapacitated,
you'll have to wrap up,
and to permit passive euthanasia for those requesting it or having it requested by doctor or family. The hidden purpose under the very respectful-sounding title of Death with Dignity lies the real message, which says we want freedom for passive and active euthanasia because some lives are more important than others in determining the quality and quantity of human population. And we might be reminded, as the man from the concentration camp experience said, that in Nazi Germany, a euthanasia program organized under the Weimar Republic by the medical profession merged into Hitler's genocide program of 1941.
Ms. Smith, I'm going to have to ask you.
Okay, real quickly, I'll finish. In the reality of our existence, death and decay need no encouragement. With or without passive neglect, they come inevitably. Life, on the other hand, requires active effort, intelligence, hard work, unselfish caring, and sometimes inconvenient sacrifice. SB 20 neglects to protect life and thus promotes death. I ask you to table it. If we want to do something in this area, and I think we all agree there are problems, then the current Oregon law regarding the terminally ill contains control factors and protects life, and we would be wiser to amend it and improve it rather than...
Thank you, Ms. Smith.
Repeal it.
Sherry Ferrigno.
Good evening. I have a short one-page testimony, so I hope that I'll get through it very quickly. Thank you very much for sticking out today. It's been a long day.
You're welcome, Ms. Brigno.
Honorable legislators, I'd like to point out and amend my testimony that since 1969 and 1970, somewhere in there, our physicians have not been taking the Hippocratic Oath and therefore do not promise to prolong the life of anyone. So those people who are concerned about being hooked up to all kinds of machines that Medicare won't pay for and reimburse the doctor and his fee schedule for might want to take that into consideration. Regarding Senate Bill 20 and 21, I would like to oppose them because these bills address the quality of life as opposed to the sanctity of life. As a result, they don't deal with dignity, but with the death of those individuals deemed to have no quality of life. Both bills result in healthcare professions crossing the boundary from dealing with physical problems into solving social problems. On March 15, 1986, the American Medical Council unanimously decided, declared that ethical, the AMA declared it ethical to withdraw food and water from patients who were not terminally ill. Their position was that it was ethical to withhold all means of life-prolonging medical treatment. The patients immediately imperiled by the policy were about 10,000 comatose, irreversible patients. Molly McCain was in an irreversible coma resulting from a traffic accident and clinically dead at the scene of the accident. Today, she's fully recovered due to her family's monitoring of her medical procedures. And it was at the family's insistence she be given every chance for full recovery. AMA's attitude toward those patients in comas would have cost Molly's life without family intervention. Physicians discontinued her feeding tube because of stenosis. Swallowing by mouth was impossible. Only family assistance for aggressive treatment resulted in a gastro tube inserted into the stomach and a tracheostomy tube to remove fluid from the lungs. I'd like to make three observations from Molly's case. First, physicians use statistics to determine prognosis and treatment. Statistically, Molly's coma was irreversible. Statistics are a poor guide when it becomes a question of life and death. A second consideration physicians use is quality of life, which is not a medical consideration, but a social consideration. For Molly, again, they were wrong. She lives in Steilacoom, Washington, by the way. A third aspect of AMA's failure to distinguish between treatment not leading to recovery or comfort and treatment that will result in death, for example, removing her feeding tube without any provision for nourishment. With these facts in mind and the fact that doctors no longer take the Hippocratic Oath, the technical problems pointed out in SB 20 and 21 by our lawyers become even more alarming. Philosophically, laws need to be written so that individuals of bad faith cannot abuse the law. SB 20 and 21 are written for individuals of good faith. They will not accomplish the goals of patient choice during the last hours of life, giving patients as wide a range of options as possible to determine their own health care. Allowing a minor child to sign a declaration regarding medical procedures has been addressed, and it does make a lot of problems. It's counter to most of our laws regarding minor children. And Section 4, line 19, includes nutrition and hydration so that physicians can take food and water from patients. And this opens up abuse to those who have AIDS, which is a coming problem that you're going to have to be dealing with this legislative session. And it also reaches patients who would live if treated but would die quickly without treatment. The durable power of attorney is also very difficult, and I have written at the bottom a little equation. AMA policy plus SB 20 equals passive euthanasia, and AMA policy plus SB 21 equals passive euthanasia plus loss of quality medicine. And again, I would ask you to consider the technical things the lawyers have brought up this session. I respectfully request both bills be killed, not amended and not tabled, because of the vast technical problems inherent in each one of them. And I thank you very much for your patience.
Thank you very much, Ms. Frigno. Next witness, Roger Fleming.
Yeah, my name's Roger. I don't think names are important. I think life's important. I'd like to start out by apologizing because I don't have too much polish here, but I'll start by getting graphic. Anybody who can't get to the crux of the issue here is either a moron or a liar. And what I mean by that is this. Money. Now that that's out of the way, let's get carried away with the philosophical implications here. Death does not bring dignity at any rate. No way. Dignity is something you get when you're alive, and then you can't even claim it. It's something somebody else has got to give to you. And that's what we should be doing to our old people, taking care of them, not murdering them or giving someone else the right to murder them. That's all I got to say.
Thank you very much.
I think she's here.
Yes, sir. Victoria Trobisch. Trobisch. Let's see. Craig DeMo.
Members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, for the record, my name is Craig DeMo. I'm speaking tonight on behalf of the Oregon Association of Evangelicals as well as the Greater Portland Association of Evangelicals. Just for the sake of reference, the Oregon Association comprises over 1,500 local churches in the state as well as parachurch ministries with memberships estimated at between 250,000 and 300,000 in Oregon. I'm speaking today in opposition to the two bills in question. Let me take this opportunity to thank and commend this committee for your extreme indulgence and patience in this whole matter. And I've gone through my printed testimony and just underlined some thoughts that I'll abbreviate very quickly. Four major problems on the document you have in front of you. First of all, we believe that both bills are extremely vague and open to many abuses, and that the current living will statute, although it's not a perfect system by any means, does allow for patient determination in imminent death situations. And since that is already available, we question the necessity of Senate Bills 20 and 21. Secondly, the primary focus, we believe, is in relieving doctors of liability for dealing in the area of withholding life-sustaining procedures, rather than in patient self-determination. Thirdly, the definition of life-sustaining procedures is itself precarious. Of course, I'm referring to the inclusion of nutrition and hydration. Although the bills speak to nutrition and hydration supplied by artificial means, it must be noted that food and water, regardless of how it is provided ordinarily, is considered to be patient care, not medical treatment. And we question whether the radical departure that this would constitute from past medical practice and understanding would be in our best interest. Fourthly, is the latitude it gives to minors 15 years or older. We just do not believe that this is consistent with the current Oregon statute. We would respectfully request that the committee table both Senate Bill 20 and Senate Bill 21. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. DeMille. Christina Purvis.
Senator Hill, members of the committee. My name is Christine Purvis, and I'm from Portland. I had the privilege for two sessions working with the Senate Revenue Committee, and one session as the Senate Journal Clerk, so I can appreciate the long hours you put in. And I must tell you, it feels different on this side of the table. I'm here today, first of all, wanting to thank the task force and the committee for looking at these issues, because I think they're incredibly important. And as Surgeon General Koop recently said, for every baby doe born today, there will be 15,000 granny does by the end of the 1990s. So clearly this issue is going to come back, and each of us will have to deal with it, whether it's for ourselves or our loved ones. Because of medical technology, there now exists a fine line between preserving life, all the life to which a person is entitled, and prolonging the act of dying. The distinction, though fragile, is there and must be kept. Senate Bill 20 concerns me in several areas. First and chiefly, a dramatic shift is made in the definition of extraordinary medical treatment to include the withholding or withdrawing of artificial provision of nutrition and hydration. As a society, we have come to view intravenous feeding as ordinary rather than extraordinary. We must call the withdrawal of nutrition and water what it is. It is an overt act. It is not passive. It is starving a person. It is assisting the act of dying. Paul Ramsey, emeritus professor at Princeton University, rejects the classification of nutrition and hydration as medical treatment, saying, and I quote, "Nourishment is not a medical treatment. Death must be the aim of stopping food and water. Here, omission can only mean we intend death," end quote. By withdrawing hydration and nutrition, it is not the illness that causes death. It is the starvation that causes death. The bill clearly states that the intent is not mercy killing, but if it isn't mercy killing, I'm at a loss to know what it is. As one woman recently said to me, these issues weren't around 100 years ago because we didn't have the medical technology to prolong life. Yet do we say no to antibiotics because a century ago they weren't around? If we follow that logic, we wouldn't perform extraordinary feats to cure pneumonia, venereal disease, cancer. I notice that the time is running out, so I'll try to be brief. Another point of the bill that I'm opposed to is the provision which allows for the withdrawal of life-sustaining measures even when the person is not in the active and natural process of death, such as those in a coma. I think we need to be careful at this point because I think we've crossed a line. At this point, we're no longer prolonging death, we are deliberately ending life. Current law does provide for living wills, and I think it should. However, this bill takes us a step closer to mandating that each person have a living will. Section 7, subsection 1 makes a provision for action to be taken when an individual has not left a directive. Therefore, to protect myself, I had best have a living will, lest care be withheld or withdrawn that I would not have chosen for myself. Must we mandate this legislatively? I can appreciate the task force's efforts and aims. It is a thorny problem. Yet each individual case must be considered on its own merits. I would agree with Dr. Charles Norris that if we err, let's err on the side of preservation of life. For once we've taken this step, and in essence legalized starvation, it will be easier for the next steps to quickly follow. After all, starvation is inhumane, so why not just use a lethal injection? Once we start down this road, the implications are ominous. We must have a framework which allows us to value all human life. Born, unborn, handicapped, senile, healthy, infirm. As Professor Ramsey said, to choose to assist to the dying process actively is to throw the gift of life back in the face of the giver. I would heartily urge the committee to table Senate Bills 20 and 21, as I feel that current law is sufficient. Thank you.
You're welcome, Ms. Purvis. Next witness, Henry Kane.
Members of the committee, Mr. Kane's testimony are in your red notebooks.
Okay. Marie Fromhertz.
Honorable Chairman and everyone on the Judiciary Committee, and all the senators that aren't here, and every person in this room. I said all the senators who aren't here because...
Go ahead and identify yourself.
I am Marie Fromhers from Salem, Oregon. I said all the senators that aren't here because I made a big mistake. I wrote a letter that you all received to all the people on the Judiciary Committee. Probably received either Saturday or yesterday. And I was opposed to Senate Bill 20 and 21, but I put in there, I begged you to floor it. So, anyway, and I thought I wrote a great letter. And then,
and then I bet you did.
I found out what I really meant to say was table. Please table.
So, I think we get the point.
So if you could tell the other senators, I'd appreciate it. to me, the important issue in all of this, to me, isn't really the forcing of people or people's loved ones to, by law, keep life-sustaining procedures going in these very... Like in any cases, there's the very sad cases we heard today. I can understand the people and why they favored SB 20 and 21 and their situation. But to me, that isn't what really is the important thing at issue. I mean, it's important, but the most important thing to me that is at issue is the fact that Senate Bill 20 and 21 are the most important, they'd be the most terrible bill to ever be passed since 1973's legalization of abortion. And that's because even though the bill is worded so nicely that someone who didn't learn more about it could easily say that there's nothing wrong with it, because of what it doesn't say, and because it opens the door, a terrible door. The door it opens is, and it doesn't mean that the legislators are terrible because they're considering it, because I don't think they realize that this bill, and that's why I came up here to talk, and I'll try to get done, this bill opens the door for euthanasia. It opens the door for mercy killing, assisted suicide, and suicide by choice. A lot of people, when they're sick, they sure love to be relieved, and it's a terrible temptation. But suicide is against God's law, His will. Eventually, anyone who is considered by others to be too miserable and suffering too much to live will eventually be able to be, killed. People like me who have been in two nervous breakdowns when I was so sick they never thought I'd ever get back together again and was the sickest one in the hospital. And they could just, do me away. But I'm glad they didn't. Eventually, all kinds of people and doctors will be asked to commit murder. And it'll be nicely worded in the nice words like that are in SB 20 and 21 and so on. And the doctors who do not believe in euthanasia will gradually be forced to resign or go against their God-given conscience. And death by starvation and lack of water is very painful. And the men put in the starvation chamber of the Nazi war camps cried the loudest and the longest until they couldn't anymore. And that was the most feared place to go. When the Nazi Germans spread euthanasia, they used the terms choice and removal and selection. Time is up.
Just okay. Go ahead and summarize.
Okay.
Finish up.
Okay. Let's see then. Well, I say, God says, thou shalt not kill, and old age, pain, illness, suffering can help people prepare. It can help them prepare for eternity. It gives them great reason and motivation and time to get themselves ready for death and judgment by God, and we hope heaven, which we're all working toward, and we pray heaven, and we pray not hell. And many people draw close to God during this time of while they're sick and toward death. And I'll end with as long as there is life, there is hope.
Thank you very much, Ms. Bromer. Yes, John Pumilla.
Hi, my name is John Pumilla, and I represent the Southern Oregon Legislative Linkup, which is a coalition of like-minded people in the Southern Oregon area. And I'm up here from Grants Pass to read a letter expressing how we feel. It's on behalf of Steve Kalfalianos. Death with dignity is a benign description for euthanasia. No matter what it's called, our state assembly should not be involved in establishing guidelines or dealing with related peripheral issues, legal or otherwise, that give credence or viability to such concepts. Euthanasia is ghoulish in its inception and barbaric in its application. Clinically neat legalities or altruistically sounding platitudes do not wash or perfume the stench of legalized murder. As you are probably aware, to aid and abet is a phrase used to describe those who are in some way involved in facilitating the commission of a crime or involved in helping someone abscond the consequences of such acts. For God's sake, don't commit yourself to either. Defeat SB 20 and 21. And that says what I have to say in a nutshell. Okay.
Thank you very much, and thank you for coming so far. Betty Freehoff.
Thank you, Chairman Hill, Judiciary members. I've got to tell you a little funny story here. I'm a detail keeper, so I started keeping time at 3 o'clock, and I want to tell you, ladies and gentlemen of this Judiciary Committee, that those against this bill started out with a 45-minute handicap. And we are now at 117 minutes against and 149 for, and we're catching up. I just wanted to share that with you. In fact, the first 45 minutes, you probably could have all gone to the TV room and seen a rerun on Town Hall, because that, like Sharon Caldwell had said earlier, was primarily what we had was a repeat. My name is Betty Freehoff. I am editor and publisher of Legislative Action Newsletter. I monitor the legislature, and I send out a weekly newsletter. In the interest of time, I just want to say everybody has covered everything that I wanted to say, except I held my breath every time someone would come up here thinking maybe they took my idea. We all want to come up to the table with a new, fresh idea. Each of you are asked to take an oath to uphold the Constitution. Section 4, of the section, I forget it wrong here. Anyway, it's under the legislature, section 21. I can define it in 19 words. Every act and joint resolution shall be plainly worded, avoiding as far as practical the use of technical terms. That to me says that this bill, and we've been hearing it very, very often today, many of the attorneys have said it, this bill is vague. And anything that is vague, I have a little term in my legislative newsletter, when in doubt, check it out. And the same way here, when in doubt, take it out. Don't vote for it. That's my my theory on this. I believe the living will statute is sufficient. I would suggest that you allow it to die in committee. Also, being as I think I'm ahead of the schedule, I have some testimony from a lady. I was handed it to Karen LeBlanc. She says, I oppose SB 20 and 21 on the basis of the sanctity of life as opposed to the quality of life. Dr. J. Engelbert Dumphy, in the annual oration before the Massachusetts Medical Society in 1976, said, quote, history shows clearly the frighteningly short steps from the living will to death control, to thought control, and finally to the systematic elimination of all but those selected for slavery or to make up the master race. We physicians must take care that support for an innocent but quite unnecessary living will does not pave the way for us to be executioners while the decisions for death are made by a panel of objective experts or by Big Brother himself. The year 1984 is not far away. C. Everett Koop, M.D., and Malcolm Muggeridge, forgive me, in the same book, both point out that Hitler's Holocaust began with euthanasia. The guiding philosophy of the Nazis was Hegelian in that, I guess I should have read this earlier, in that what was considered rational utility and corresponding doctrine and planning had replaced moral, ethical, and religious values. I suggest that we as a nation already operate on the basis of rational utility when the U.S. Supreme Court can decide a nationwide policy of abortion on demand that even our own president writes is not constitutional law and gives almost no sense of an obligation to be. Our Declaration of Independence stated the vision of our forefathers using words school children recite. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they endowed by their creator and with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. In my opinion, neither SB 20 nor 21 is consistent with our Declaration of Independence, but rather with the Nazis' Hegelian philosophy of rational utility. It's signed Karen LeBlanc, 1276 Northeast 9th place in Canby, Oregon, and I've got some written testimony, and I will pass it out to you. I also have, I would like to go on record, there's a lady in Hillsboro. Her name is Joanne K. Cruzman. She lives at 933 Northwest 10th. She's against this bill, and I have a Dr. Finley that is in Tigard, and he's also against this bill, and thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Friel. Next witness, David Ingerson. Okay. Joe Spinner.